One of the things that was real clear in that narrative is the fact that Jacob came from leaning on his own ability, his own, you know, husbandry and his own manipulative ability and his own strength of sneakiness to get what he wanted. And then he recognized, and this was all a process, really, the culmination of that process was when he was wrestling with God, but all came to that point where God told him, you can't, I'm going to win. But in the process, by me winning, you're going to win. So you need to depend on my strength, not on your own. Who else have we seen? Moses, all right? Moses. And specifically, we looked at the instance when Moses asked God to show me your glory. God, show me your glory. So what changed in that circumstance? How did Moses change? He didn't get a name change. So what changed there? What was the point of all of this encounter with God? What was God drawing Moses into an understanding of? Say what? Yeah. He was equipping him to realize and recognize this is what I've made you for. This is what I've called you to do. And specifically, we looked at the fact that he was a mediator, an intercessor between the children of Israel and Yahweh God. Holy, righteous, vengeful, and properly so. He was the intermediary. He was the go-between. And God was drawing him into an understanding of that. And as he saw the character and nature of God, and it was just one part of God, right? It was his goodness that passed before him. When he encountered that, he understood in a clearer way what it meant to serve that kind of God and what it meant to follow him. And he was solidified in his own desire to be God's man, to be that interceder between the children of Israel and God. Who else have we seen who have drawn near to God? Abraham, yep, Abraham, which is actually one of the things that changed because he started out as Abram, right? And his name was changed to Abraham. That was the first one we looked at. And remember, in that narrative, you see these two strangers walking into the camp there, into his tent or toward his tent. And initially, he had no concept of who they were. But what did they show him? What did especially the Christophany bring him into an understanding of? Do you remember where that whole narrative kind of centered around? What event? Sodom and Gomorrah, right? God asks the question, should we let this guy, we just talked about the promise of God, the covenant promise that was made with this guy and with his descendants. Should we bring him into our confidence? Should we show him what's going to happen? And they bring him and they describe what's going to occur here in Sodom and Gomorrah. And Abraham, in response to drawing near to God, what happens? What does he do? He barters with God. Really? He comes before God and he says, okay, well, I don't want especially my family, and I think it's a fair assumption, and I think we established that it was a fair assumption, that he was mostly concerned with his family that was in town there. He said, look, yeah, they deserve to be destroyed, but I'd really like to protect the family. And so he prays and he asks bold questions of God. And God demonstrates repeatedly patience with Abraham and the line of questions that Abraham was bringing before him. And finally, at the end of that negotiation, he brings it down so far that he's sure, he's certain that Lot and his family should be okay because of the number of righteous that he agreed to. But what ends up happening? There weren't even that many. And yet God in his goodness still protected Lot and his wife and his daughters. That was it, right? That was the situation. So you look at that and you recognize in that instance, God is demonstrating that he will do justly and rightly, and you can count on God to do that. One other. Gideon. 2 weeks ago we looked at Gideon. So what changed with Gideon? When he drew near to God, when he saw God for who he was, what changed with Gideon? Anybody remember? No? All right. Well, one thing that changed was his name as well. He got a different name, not Gideon. That name stayed the same, but he got a nickname. Do you guys remember the nickname that all the people around him called him? Let Baal contend with him. Remember that? They said, let's call him, let's nickname this guy, Baal's got a curse on this dude. Let's call him that, because we don't want to get near him in case Baal decides to get angry with him, because he destroyed his father's grove and his high places, right? So definitely one of the things that changed about him was a nickname. But what else changed, and what did that nickname demonstrate with Gideon? What else had changed with him? He had the confidence to obey God despite his fear. That's very well stated. In spite of his terror and fear, he still did what God wanted him to do. So much so that he got recognized among the village fathers as one who was a rabble rouser. Can you imagine that would be the aspect that he had? You know, before, when you encounter him, he's this little meek guy in the bottom of a pit trying to get enough flour to make some bread. And next thing you know, within 24 hours, he's called by the village fathers the one that Baal's going to curse because he's that brazen and bold. And Gideon's standing there saying, I didn't want to even do this. I don't even know. I'm the weakest of the tribe of Manasseh, and I'm the smallest in my family, and I don't really think this is a good idea. But if you say so. The thing is, with Gideon, when you encounter that change with him, that transformation within him, he begins to trust God and have confidence in God in spite of the fear. Because God says, have I not told you I will do this? And the last thing we saw is it says God clothed himself with Gideon. God said, I'm going to use you, Gideon. I'm going to come in and I am going to transform you, and I'm going to use you in a dramatic fashion to rescue the people, but I'm going to do it in a way that no one can doubt who did it. Because there's going to be no question in anyone's mind that it wasn't you, because you're weak and cowardly and a little nerdy. It actually is going to be obvious that it's me. And the funny thing is, even with Gideon, as the story developed with him, there were many opportunities for him to, you know, people wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt very soon into the process. They're like, oh, well, maybe he is a really good leader. Maybe he is really good at compelling people to come. I mean, look how many men showed up. This is awesome. And God says, okay, well, let's pare this down. And he continued to pull back on the show of force and common sense, so that the thing that would rise to the surface was the fact that God was the one that was doing the work on behalf of the nation. When God drew Gideon near to himself, he transformed his name as well and his character. One of the things that you'll recognize, a thread that runs through all of these, there are a number of them. One of the things is that God often will change the name or the essential character of the individual, but also he does it based on his covenant promise. Remember, we talked about the fact that often these encounters with God are based on the promise that he made to the people, to the children of Israel, to Abraham and his descendants, that he would bless, honor, and protect. And so when God comes and he draws near to these individuals, he's doing it unilaterally. He's saying, I am going to come and step into the scene, and I'm going to continue to protect those that I've said I will protect. In fact, even in Moses' case, he says, I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious. You can have confidence that in spite of the sin of this nation, and in spite of their rebellion and their propensity to run away from my plan, I will continue to keep my promise. God is establishing that he keeps his promises. We're going to go to another section here in Isaiah today, and I want to look at this individual especially closely. In Isaiah chapter 6, verse 5, this is that theme verse. This is the verse, I think, that sort of puts into our minds or sort of solidifies in our understanding the heart of the transformation that occurs. Isaiah 6, 5, and I said, and this is Isaiah speaking, I said, woe is me, for I am lost. For I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Clearly, somebody had encountered God. Clearly, somebody had been with God. One of the things that's really neat about the book of Isaiah is that often we go there during Christmas season, because there are some astounding sections and passages in Isaiah that describe in incredible poetic detail the significance of the coming Messiah. I mean, the book of Isaiah is one of the heaviest in terms of messianic prophecy. One of the most beautiful places we can go. So much so that you have people writing songs, right? What do they call that? It's not an opus. What do you call the thing that was it an opus? Can we call it an opus? We'll call it an opus. Where they read an entire song. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. Handel's Messiah. I mean, that was based on this idea. So Isaiah had a pretty amazing insight into Messiah. But the thing that's interesting about Isaiah is that we often don't know much about his history. So this morning, what I want to do is I want to look at where he came from and what was some of the circumstances around his life before he came to this place where he penned chapter 6. But before we do that, let's read through Isaiah chapter 6 so we can get a little idea of what Isaiah saw and how he described his encounter with God. Isaiah chapter 6 and verse 1. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim. Each had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the foundations of the thresholds shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, "Woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hands a burning coal that he had taken with tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth and said, "Behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away, and your sin atoned for." And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send? And who will go for us?" Then I said, "Here am I, send me." And he said, "Go and say this to the people." And I'm going to stop there because we're going to come to this next section in a second, but I don't want to spoil that part of it until we get a little bit more context with what we're seeing here. Isaiah sees God. He encounters the holy, holy, holy Lord God Almighty in the temple. And as a result of that encounter, what is his response? He falls on his face immediately and says, he covers his mouth and says, "I am unclean, I am unholy and wretched, woe is me, I am lost." You know what's interesting about all of these encounters with God, or in just about every instance? When people recognize and realize that they have actually seen God, what happens? What is the first response out of most of these people? Gideon, Isaiah, "I am unworthy. I don't know why I'm doing this. This is crazy. I'm going to die." Remember Gideon's response? "Please, oh no, I saw him face to face. I'm going to die." And God had to come back after he left and said, "Relax. It's all right. You're going to live. It's going to be okay." When they encounter God for real, the first response is terror. Terror at the holiness of God, at the majesty of God. You know what I think is missing in a lot of expressions of worship today? Terror. Amazement. Wonder. Fear. Why? Why do you suppose that is? Why is it that we've lost the sense of God's majesty? Yeah. What is majesty? What is glory? What is the holiness of God? It's a recognition of the distance between him and me. I looked up and saw God high and lifted up, and his whole train filled the temple. I saw the distance between him and me. But man doesn't want that. What was the first sin? What was the first thing that man wanted to do? I want to be like God. What is the heart of sin? It's to put myself, to elevate myself to the place of God, to allow myself to make my own calls, to allow myself to decide for myself what I think is right or wrong. And suddenly God becomes an advisor, a buddy. He's no longer holy. He's now something I can use to my advantage when I'm confused after I've sort of expended all my resources. So I make as much of the distance as I can, and I'm right there, but I just need one other little thing. So, hey, God, I apologize for busy. You know, I know you're busy, but just real quick here, I'm pretty sure I know what I'm going to do here, but I got these last two, and I don't really want to flip a coin. So if you'd rather I flip the coin, I'll go that route, but why don't you just let me know real quick what you think? He's become this advisor. We've elevated ourselves, and he is no longer holy and majestic. He's a buddy. He's a friend I can ask a question to when I feel like it. The thing about what you encounter, whenever you see somebody who saw God, is that they immediately are struck by his majesty. So the question inevitably becomes, is that the same God that we're worshiping and serving today? Well, of course. God is unchanging. He has the same aspect, the same character, he's the same God. He is forever the I am that I am, the self-existent one. That's who we're worshiping. So there should be that same sense of amazement, of fear, of terror when we recognize I am approaching the throne of grace. And yet, that's what makes boldness when I go before that throne of grace so amazing. I can go boldly before the throne of grace and find mercy. Why can I go boldly? You know what? A lot of people go boldly before the throne of grace today. Oh yeah, I'm going to pray real fast. Oh, just dear God, blah, 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 and then I'm done. And in their mind, they think, well, you know, that was a bold thing. I just stepped right in there and I said my piece and I left. That wasn't bold. What does boldness require? To be bold, you first have to recognize the terror of the situation. And then in boldness, you step forward because you have something that you're depending on. The boldness that draws us into the throne of grace is a recognition first that I don't belong here. I don't deserve to be here. And yet, because of the blood of Christ, I can stand on His righteousness in boldness and speak to God as a friend. But not because I've diminished Him at all, but because the blood of Christ has bridged the gap. It elevates the gospel instead of diminishing that gospel. But often, our experience or our encounter with God is the opposite. We see Him in very simple, very, very human terms. And that's not at all what Isaiah encountered. Let's go back to the book of 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles. And the reason we're going to go back to 2 Chronicles is because the first thing that we have to do is get a picture of who this guy is. I want us to understand a little bit more about his character. And that's one of the things that I really enjoy about this Draw Near series, is that we get a chance to sort of step into the shoes of these guys and see the life that they lived a little bit and recognize where they're coming from. So you notice in the first verse of the chapter 6, verse 1 of Isaiah, it says, in the year that King Uzziah died. So immediately my mind says, well, who's this King Uzziah character? All right, who is this guy? So we're going to go to 2 Chronicles chapter number 26. And we're going to introduce ourselves to Uzziah. Because it'll help us to understand a little bit better where Isaiah is coming from. 2 Chronicles chapter number 26. Let's get a picture of the conditions. And all the people of Judah took Uzziah, who was 16 years old, and made him king instead of his father Amaziah. And he built Elath and restored it to Judah after the king slept with his fathers. Uzziah was 16 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 52 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Jecolah of Jerusalem, and he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. According to all that his father Amaziah had done, he set himself to seek God in the days of Zechariah, who instructed him in the fear of God. And as long as he sought the Lord, God made him prosper. This is Uzziah. I like Uzziah. I like this guy. So 16 years old, he's made king. That in itself is a really interesting thing. Brody, how old are you? That's what I thought. So just for a second, let's envision for a moment that we decide randomly in this context that we're going to establish Brody as the ruler of our nation. I mean, you look at that, and no offense to Brody, and we're friends, so I could say this. I don't know how much confidence I would entirely have. I mean, I know the good news is we would probably all have four-wheelers. I mean, that'd be like the first thing. Everybody, four-wheelers for all! And then we would, you know, I don't know, there'd be all kinds of other fun stuff that I'm sure would happen as a result of your presidency. But the fact is, when you recognize, as a 16-year-old, there's a lot of life that still hasn't been lived. There's still a lot of stuff that hasn't, you know, experiences that you haven't yet had, wisdom that hasn't yet established itself. Not that you're not wise, Brody. I trust you, man. I trust you. So the thing is, when Uzziah was made as king here, this is a pretty significant occurrence. 16 years old, and they say, well, we're going to establish you as king. And the thing that I find most amazing about Uzziah is in verse 5. He set himself to seek God in the days of Zechariah. He set himself to seek God. The reason why he was so successful, the reason why he was called a good king, was because he established early on in the process of his authority and rulership here that he was going to follow God. And he set himself on that path. It's an intentional action. There's a lot of times when it seems like, and especially for young men, it seems like there's not a lot of setting yourself toward anything. You know what I mean? You're like, well, I'll do this. I don't know. Maybe this. I'm not sure. I'll figure it out. You know, the thing is, Uzziah at this point knew what was necessary. He said, I'm going to establish or set myself to seek after God. I'm going to surround myself with individuals that can instruct me in the fear of the Lord. He goes to Zechariah and he says, I need to know God like my father knew him. I need to have that established from the get-go. And so he very quickly recognizes that without God, there's no hope. And so much so that at the end of that section, it says, as long as he sought the Lord, God made him to prosper. Listen, he was king for 52 years. Now, admittedly, he got an early start. So that was to his advantage. But still, 52 years in this context is amazing. That's a legacy. Not many kings made it that long. Not many of these kings managed to stay on the throne that long. Really, Uzziah comes second only to probably Solomon and David. In terms of his magnificence as king, as you continue to read, you'll see this even more. He went out and made war in verse number six, went out and made war against the Philistines and broke through the wall of Gath and the wall of Jabineth and the wall of Ashdod. And he built cities in the territory of Ashdod and elsewhere among the Philistines. Who are the Philistines again? Who is Gath? Does Gath ring a bell to you? Philistines and specifically Gath? Giants, right? Why do you think giants? Why does he immediately jump to giants there? Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was a family in Gath that had a thing going for them, and it usually involved giants. I mean, that was amazing. This was Gath, and this is the guy. Uzziah says he's gonna take it to the Philistines. He's gonna go and he's gonna attack these things. I mean, you wanna raise your reputation in a nation? Go against the hated, despised enemies of your nation and break through the wall of one of their best cities and start building settlements in one of their other cities. I mean, he's doing some pretty good work here. He is establishing himself as a warrior. He's establishing himself as a leader. He does all of these things. And he builds these cities. God helped him against the Philistines and against the Arabians who lived in Gerbil, against the Meunites and the Ammonites paid tribute to Uzziah. The Ammonites paid tribute to Uzziah. What is that? What is this Ammonites paying tribute thing? He's beginning to tax these places that he's defeated. I mean, this guy is fantastic. He's the quintessential warrior king. He is going out and he's establishing these outposts in all of these nations and he's receiving tribute and tax from them. The coffers are growing. His reputation is growing. And it's all because why? Why is that occurring with Uzziah? The answer is in the text there. What's going on? He sought the Lord and verse 7, God helped him. God helped him. God was establishing Uzziah. God was using these things that Uzziah was doing. It's not like Uzziah was out for his own. It appears, at least from all indications, that God was using Uzziah's natural talent and ability, but in addition, enabling him to go beyond that for the glory of God and to establish the reputation of the children of Israel. So they were receiving this tribute from the Ammonites, and his fame spread even to the border of Egypt, for he became very strong. Moreover, see, you could stop there and be like, man, this guy's great. But then it says, moreover, Uzziah built towers in Jerusalem at the corner gate and at the valley gate and at the angle and fortified them. And he built towers in the wilderness and cut out many cisterns, for he had large herds both in the Shephelah and in the plain. And he had farmers and vine dressers in the hills and in the fertile lands, for he loved the soil. Man, I like this guy. So now, in addition to the fact that he has a very strong offensive approach where he's pushing the boundaries out into these other nations and establishing his reputation all the way to the border of Egypt, but in addition, he's fortifying the city of Jerusalem. He builds these fortified towers on all corners of the city, and he also builds these watchtowers into the valleys and into the wilderness around the city. I mean, he's establishing a good defensive plan as well. And not only that, but he also loves the soil. I mean, suddenly you go from warrior king to like this, you know, kind of what's that? Bonanza? What was the name of Cartwright? What's Cartwright? What's his first name? Come on. No one knows Mr. Cartwright's first name? Ben, thank you. I knew somebody here could, you know, kind of this regal sense, you know, you could kind of envision him sitting in his overstuffed, you know, leather chair as he sees his herds and all of these things and his land. And he's got just this sense of he loves the land, you know. Oh, this guy's a man's man, loves the land, fights. He's a good guy. And he has done all of this work as a result of God establishing him and giving him this sense of what needed to be accomplished. Moreover, Uzziah in verse 11 had an army of soldiers fit for war. That's always nice. When you have an army of soldiers, but also an army of soldiers that are fit for war, that's even better. You know, guys that can actually fight, that know what they're doing. He has this army of soldiers that are fit for war in divisions according to the numbers and the musters made by Jeriel, the secretary of Maniah, the officer. I mean, this guy's even organized. Oh, I can't stand him. Under the direction of Hananiah, one of the king's commanders. The whole number of the head of the father's house of mighty men of valor was 2,600. You guys know about the mighty men of valor, right? Tell me some of the mighty men of valor. Who are some of those? We talked about them once long ago when we were talking about obscure guys in scripture. Do you guys remember any of the mighty men? I'm sorry, who? Benaiah, you stole Ben's. He wants to change his name to Benaiah. Benaiah, mighty man of valor, you know? Yeah, he was one of these really interesting characters who has kind of a GoPro mentality. You know how you guys have seen GoPros? These little cameras that go on like in your hat or on your chest or on your bike or whatever. You shouldn't probably give that to guys. Because now, where before you might have been a little cautious, but then you could sort of expand the story. The fish was that big. I mean, now you have a camera to record it, so you can't lie about how epic it was. So it has to be as epic as you're going to describe. And so you just, driving. Yeah, anyway. That was kind of Benaiah. He had that mentality. These mighty men of valor were men of reputation, men of renown, men who had skills, the special forces. They were often the ones that were responsible for caring for the king. 2,600 of these guys. And they were in charge over these divisions of men. So they were training and establishing these guys. This is a pretty good situation, especially in this culture. If you didn't have this kind of resource, you're in trouble. But they did. Under the command was an army of 307,500. Who could make war with mighty power to help the king against the enemy. And Uzziah prepared for all the army shields, spears, helmets, coats of mail, bows, stones for slinging, berettas, glocks, no. I mean, this guy was fantastic. He established, he gave these men all of these resources to be successful. He established not just that he wanted this big army, but he wanted a well-equipped army. And so they had all the latest and greatest technology, you know? They had technological advances. That last one is a pretty big deal, the stones for slinging. Because if you read further in verse 15, in Jerusalem he made engines invented by skillful men to be on the towers and the corners to shoot arrows and great stones. And his fame spread far, for he was marvelously helped till he was strong. This is like a little boy's dream right here. You know, this is what you build when you're bored with all the stuff that you've built with your Legos and you decide, I don't know what to build. I mean, you build this. You got this tower, and you think, I'm going to build this catapult, you know, that flings this stone over the side, and I'm going to build these machines that'll shoot arrows. I mean, immediately your mind is drawn into this medieval war scene where you see this fortified city with all of the equipment, the engines developed or invented by skillful men to protect the city. Man, that's awesome. That's cool. This guy has all the toys. He can do whatever he wants, and he is very strong. His fame has spread from the edge of Egypt all the way over to the bay. This guy is amazing. But what does it finish with? Why is this guy so amazing? Why did all this happen? Why was he able to receive all this tribute and establish an army, a huge army with great guys and fortify the city? What was going on? He was not just helped, marvelously helped by God till he was strong. Marvelously helped. I think that word is interesting. Because we often think of God helping. God, help me. Help me, God. I need help. And we never really expect a whole lot from that, or at least I know I often don't. We say it, but we often don't mean it. But when God marvelously helps, that's not just like a little bump in the direction. Not just a little help. This was marvelous. This was to result in marvel at the significance of the assistance of God on behalf of Uzziah. That's this guy, all right? So, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord high and lifted up, says Isaiah. So who's Isaiah? Well, obviously, he was around the year that King Uzziah died. And not only is Isaiah around the year that King Uzziah died, but Isaiah himself says that he records, and we'll read this verse in a second, he records all of the goings-on during the 52 years that Isaiah is king. So Isaiah is part of Uzziah's entourage. He is one of the men that is part of the recording of the mighty deeds of Uzziah. So we don't know exactly how much older he was than Uzziah. But the thing is, when he first encounters in Isaiah 6, that's the first king that he worked with. And he works with four kings after that, after Uzziah. But he starts there. So he was probably a fairly young man himself. So for a moment, imagine that you are a prophet of a royal family who has a history of advising the kings. And you have been placed into the entourage or into the council of this 16-year-old king. And you're a young guy yourself, but you recognize in him that he seeks the Lord. And you're a prophet of the Lord. And you recognize in him that the Lord is strengthening him and establishing his kingdom. And you're the one who loves that Lord, Yahweh, and also loves this king. And this king is successful. And this king is magnificent. And he becomes famous. What's going to happen in your mind? If you're Isaiah serving that king, what is your view of that king? What do you suppose your assumption is going to be about that guy? Man, I like that guy. I'm part of his war council. I'm part of his cabinet. I'm part of his advisory crew. And man, this guy is doing great stuff. He is becoming very infamous, famous. And man, I really like this guy. That was where Isaiah was at with this king. He appears to have a very good relationship with him. So, remember, the year that Uzziah died. Okay, let's keep reading. Verse number 16. Of 2 Chronicles 26. But when he was strong, he grew proud. That is one of the saddest verses in the Bible. And it happens all the time. Happens all the time. When he was strong, he grew proud. Oh, to his destruction. For he was unfaithful to the Lord his God, and entered the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. So let me give you a picture of what happens next with this guy Uzziah. He has done everything right up to this point. He has been the warrior king. He has pushed back the borders. He has made the nation wealthy and protected and stable and safe. But there's one thing that he wasn't allowed to do. There was one piece of this whole thing that he was not part of, and that was the priestly system. Why? Why wasn't he part of the priestly system up to this point? He wasn't born into the right tribe. He wasn't born for that. What was he born for? What God was doing with him. And yet he was not satisfied with what God had for him. He wanted more. What did he want? What was he going to do? So he goes into the temple with a handful of incense that he wants to throw on this incense burner. What is that? What does that represent? What was that? What's the whole point of incense? Does anybody remember? What does it represent? Prayer. He wanted to pray. Well, that's a great thing. I mean, hey, come on, give this guy, cut him some slack. This guy just wants to go in and worship and pray. What's wrong with that? Why would we be angry with a guy who's spiritual? I mean, hey, he could have had no concern or interest or love for the temple. I mean, doesn't it seem legitimately okay that he went in there with his incense to pray? Why is that he was unfaithful to God? What do you guys think? Yeah. Yeah. Why? Why? Why is that such a problem? Yeah. Why is the holiness of our God, who is high and lifted up, minimized? Because we approach God on our terms. We say, God, I want to do it my way. I don't want to have to go to the trouble of going down to the temple and waiting for this super old priest who can barely walk to hobble over and grab a handful of this stuff and get in there and pray. I just want to do this. And God, I'm just going to pray, that's all. And God says, I have no patience. Like Dana said, no patience, no willingness to allow you to do it your way. Because that is it, the first step toward degrading and diminishing the holiness of God. You can't do that. And Uzziah, at this point, wants to do it his own way. So he steps into the temple and it begins to attempt to to worship God, to pray in his own fashion. But Azariah the priest went in after him with 80 priests of the Lord who were men of valor. This is cool. This is like the temple guard. Remember we talked about the men of valor? These are the guys who, you know, they don't mess around. They're the guys that can do what needs doing. And they see, so the thing is, it says they went after him. So this is what I envision. And, you know, it's not told here, but this is what I perceive. Uzziah, at this point, he has, you know, it's not like he just suddenly had this impulse. Oh, you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to walk in there. He probably thought this through and thought, you know what? Man, God and I, we're on good terms. We're on really good terms. Everything that I've done has turned to gold. Everything I've touched has been perfect, and God has blessed it. So why wouldn't this also be what God? Maybe I'm going to be prophet, priest, and king. You know, I'm going to be the three put together. I'm going to do all of it. And so he walks into the temple with purpose. And my guess is, in light of what we see here, that they weren't that surprised to see him. So that's good news. You know, he's probably been there before. So he walks in and he begins to walk purposefully toward the Holy of Holies. And as he walks past this cauldron of this incense, he grabs himself some and he makes a beeline straight in before anybody figures out what's going on. Wait, hold on. Was that Uzziah? Did he just go into the Holy of Holies? What did he do? Did he have incense? Oh man, sound the alarm, get the guards. And so these 80 priests, who were also men of valor, went in after him. Azariah, the chief priest, and the rest of them took off into this inner sanctum to get the king, because he is doing something that is not permitted. He is about to do something that is unholy and not part of God's plan. And so they take off after him and go in after him. And they withstood King Uzziah and said to him, "It is not for you, Uzziah, to burn incense to the Lord, but for the priests, the sons of Aaron, who are consecrated to burn incense. Go out of the sanctuary, for you have done wrong, and it will bring you no honor from the Lord God." They're honest with him. They withstand him, right? They withstood him. In my mind, that means they grabbed him in time. And they managed to stop him, and they said, "No, it is not permitted for you to do that." That's a pretty gutsy statement, by the way. Remember, who is this guy? He's the king. And not just any king, the warrior king. And he is well loved by all the people. So you can imagine how this rubbed Uzziah. He's thinking, "Man, I don't know about this. I don't know about these priests telling me what I can and can't do, where my line is. It's not for me, but only if I was born of the sons of Aaron to burn incense, because you've been consecrated. Why are you consecrated and why am I not consecrated?" Then Uzziah was angry. That was a very bad idea. Now he had a censer in his hand to burn incense, and he became angry with the priests. And when he became angry with the priests, leprosy broke out on his forehead in the presence of the priests in the house of the Lord by the altar of incense. So at this point, the response that Uzziah has to what's going on is he has this cauldron with the incense in it. And he has it and he's holding it to himself. And they're trying to take this from him, to wrestle it from his hands. He's right there ready to do it by this altar. And he's angry with these priests and he's mad and he says, "It's not fair. I should be able to do this as well. This is not fair that I can't have this responsibility and role. I'm the king. I'm the one that deserves all the honor and glory in this regard. You are priests. You didn't even have to try. I mean, I've gone to all the trouble of fortifying the city and building all these armaments, and I have these men, and I have all this wonderful land and houses and wealth, and why can't I also do this?" And at that moment, leprosy broke out on his forehead. What is leprosy? Biblically, what does leprosy represent? Death, for sure. You will die of it. You are separated immediately from the rest of all of society. It's a picture of sin. It's that cancer that is inside of all of us. That sin that longs to take control. And once you have leprosy, it spreads to every part of your body. It starts in one place and moves throughout. And you begin to lose fingers and toes and other appendages. And you begin to lose eyesight. And you begin to lose taste. And you are just a slow, painful death. And the scripture says repeatedly, that is sin. That is what sin accomplishes. That is what it is. You want a picture, a visual of sin? It's leprosy. At this moment, can you imagine if you're the priests? You have a hold of that cauldron to make sure that he doesn't put it on the altar of incense. And the 80 priests are around and they're ready to do their duty to the king if they have to. And suddenly, as you're looking into his eyes and the anger is in his face, suddenly a spot of leprosy begins to appear on his forehead. And everybody knew what that was. You released for a second. And the king maybe is looking like, whoa, why are you guys all... And they start to step back a little. And he's thinking, what's going on? Are they willing? Are they letting me do this? Is it okay now all of a sudden? And suddenly from the back of the crowd, somebody says, unclean! And you can't look at your own forehead, but if you could, you'd imagine he would. He begins to recognize, I have been given leprosy as a punishment or representation of my own rebellion. I have been given leprosy. And Azariah the priest looked on him, and behold, he was leprous in his forehead. My Bible has an exclamation mark after that. Leprous in his forehead. And they rushed him out quickly. And he himself hurried to go out because the Lord had struck him. Suddenly he's a willing participant. I like that they have both that. They rushed him out and he himself rushed himself out. He recognized what was going on. And King Uzziah was a leper to the day of his death. And being a leper, like Charles said, he lived in a separate house, for he was excluded from the house of the Lord. And Jotham, his son, was over the king's household, governing the people of the land. Now the rest of the acts of Uzziah, from the first to the last, Isaiah, the prophet, the son of Amoz, wrote. And Uzziah slept with his fathers, and they buried him with his fathers in the burial field that belongs to the kings, for they said, he is a leper. And Jotham, his son, reigned in his place. This is Uzziah. And the reason we need to see Uzziah is because we need to recognize how that plays into Isaiah's encounter with God. And rest assured, it does. So the end of Uzziah's life is pretty uneventful. Well, except for him, I suppose. They rush him out of the temple, and they build him a place called the Separate House. And it actually is a place. Once he lived there, it established sort of as a, you know, like the TB, the old-fashioned TB wards that they have. That was kind of the place where lepers went. You know, they had to build something for the king. They couldn't just let him go live in the caves because he was still technically the king. So they build him this place called the Separate House, which is outside the city. And they establish this as where he lives. And his son Jotham becomes a regent, basically. He rules the affairs of his father's house. So he's a king now, but only in form. You know, only as a figurehead. No one sees him. No one is near him. No one goes around him. He's just the king. And then he dies. And that's the end of it. So he is removed from this sense of this place of honor and dignity, of power and of might and of distinguished recognition. You know, it talks about his fame spreads to Egypt and all these other places, and people are coming and visiting and seeing his magnificent, you know, his inventions that he's built and all of these things. And now he's separate. No one sees him. No one can go to him. No one can talk to him. He's by himself. Yeah, he's still king, but he is no longer who he was. And at the end of his days, he dies. Now, here's an interesting little piece at the end there. It talks about where he was buried. And I want to point this out just quickly because it's interesting how that fits. And then next week, we're going to look at how this all ties into Isaiah. But the thing that's interesting about this king is that it says he's buried in the field that belongs to the king. Now, does that strike you as odd? So there's a field that was dedicated to the kings, where they would have burial for the kings. And I mean, entombed there is David and Solomon and all of these other mighty men and the kings of Israel. They're in this field. So it says that he was buried in the field of the kings. But then there's a little excerpt there that says, for it was said, he is a leper. I don't get it. So is that the inscription on the tomb? Is that what it says? Here lies the leper king? I mean, what is that, for he was a leper? And yet it's tied into the place that he was buried. Here's what I suspect, and we don't know for sure, but this is what I suspect. Lepers, those that had leprosy, weren't even permitted to be buried in the same place as those that were clean. Even in death, they were considered unclean, because at that point, they had no clue how long that disease lasted. And you wouldn't want to go visiting Great Aunt Matilda's grave with flowers and suddenly come away with leprosy. So they ensured that the leprous graveyard was in a different place than those that actually had didn't have leprosy, but died of natural causes. So the fact that he was buried in the field of the kings is a pretty big deal. And I would imagine there was no small amount of arguing about whether or not this should happen. Should he be there? Should he not be there? Well, he's a leper. We can't put him next to David. We can't entomb him next to Solomon. He's a leper. Well, but he's such a good king. I mean, look what he did. He established the walls and he built all these armaments, and we're in a position that we've never been in as a nation. We can't just throw him out into a field somewhere and forget about him. He matters. That one little thing was all he did wrong. I mean, 52 years. How much of that did he have leprosy? Who knows? Two to five? I don't know how long leprosy takes to take its toll, but it's not that long. I mean, he has a whole history of great, wonderful leadership. Why would we throw it all out over one little thing? And finally, at the end, they decide that they will allow him to be in that field, but it seems that they marked that somehow. So he was forever, eternally marked, even in death, as the leprous king, the one who went against God's plan and demanded his own rights before God to pray and approach God in his own way. That's Uzziah. And that last little piece says that Isaiah, the son of Amos, was the one that chronicled the whole debacle. He saw every piece of it. If you're the chronicle of the king, if you're the one that is keeping all the records and writing them down, you know every nitty-gritty detail. You're part of every piece of it. Isaiah saw the meteoric rise of this king and then this fall at the end. He saw it all. He was privy to it all. That is Isaiah. So when we see in Isaiah 6, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. It gives a whole new context to what exactly this meant for Isaiah. And next week we're going to examine that a little bit more. But for now, let's pray. God, thank you so much, Lord, for the chance that we have to examine the lives of these individuals. Lord, I think of King Uzziah. And Lord, I praise you for the fact that, Lord, you magnified yourself through him. You marvelously worked on his behalf. You blessed and honored and protected him, Lord, and made him strong for your glory. But Lord, I also recognize in him the same thing that all of us find ourselves facing. This tendency to try to do worship, to do our relationship with you in our own way. And God, that propensity is in all of our hearts to come up with our own approach, our own path to God. Lord, I thank you that you're holy and that you are unwilling to allow that. Lord, I praise you for the fact that we have a chance to see your holiness displayed, even in punishment, Lord. And even in that, Lord, as you punish King Uzziah, you display your glory. Lord, I pray that you'll protect our own hearts from arrogance and pride. Lord, I pray that you'll give us a view of you that's appropriate, an understanding of your majesty that draws us into wonder and into fear, but also into amazement of the grace that bridges that gap. Lord, there's nothing more amazing, nothing more wondrous or marvelous than the creator and sustainer of the universe wrapping himself in flesh and coming and being born in a manger. Lord, I thank you for the fact that that in itself displays a level of condescension, Lord, that is just beyond belief. And Lord, I praise you and thank you that we can be the recipients of the results of that sacrifice. Lord, I pray that you'll keep our attention and our eyes focused on your glory. And Lord, I just thank you again for the wonderful, amazing, glorious picture of your birth. And it's in your name that we pray. Amen.